Hi, folks. Again, Paul Loney. I think Lee and I talked real briefly. It's these sort of things is more audience-friendly to questions. What's on your mind? Because we could ramble for hours being lawyers about anything. So, but we want to know
you're
what.
Like Maury, just talk it out. Be like, oh, you did not. I have a question.
No.
No, but
no, I don't know everybody. Do you know everybody here?
No.
I'll tell them about you, and then you could tell them about me.
They're like Simon and Garfunkel.
That's right. Paul Loney practices here in Portland and in Ashland statewide, looking after patients and their providers. He's legal counsel to Oregon Normal and the legal brains behind the world-famous Cannabis Cafe. He and I work together sometimes advising people who are interested in distributing medical cannabis lawfully under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act because of his business acumen. We are lucky to have him be a part of our community. When you were speaking before about the Normal Legal Committee, I know Dan Vietz and who helped draft those initiatives, and we're both members of the Normal Legal Committee, and and the Normal Lawyers are a unique group in that we're working to put ourselves out of business. We both have other job skills. Like I said, Paul's an outstanding business lawyer, and I do appeals. I'm the chair of the Normal Amicus Committee. So there is other work for us to do, and having met with Normal Lawyers nationally from the conferences that we have twice yearly, I encourage folks to go to the Normal website and find a lawyer if you find yourself in need of talking to somebody, whether it's about a forfeiture issue, an arrest, or a can of business issue. So anyway, that's my talking about you.
Yeah, I'll introduce Lee Berger. I mean, Lee, when I moved to Portland after graduating law school from U of O, Lee was already a well-known figure practicing law. He's been involved with marijuana reform since day one of his practice. And he makes sure, like Lee said, he's on the National Lawyers, National Legal Committee, if I get that one right. But Lee's always very good at reminding the lawyers there that, you know, we're there to help people, you know, and that's what we really hear about, as Lee says, putting ourselves out of business. And Lee's really good about that. And then, because as Lee's, like, some lawyers you go to, like, oh, you're a pot smoker, right? They may be a good lawyer otherwise, but, you know, Lee will take you seriously. And again, appeal work, Lee's the man. I mean, he knows, he's the one that won the handgun case here in Oregon, that medical marijuana patients can carry concealed weapons permits.
Well, yeah, John Lucy helped with that, and he's right here.
Yeah.
Or will be any minute.
Yeah, any minute John will show up.
Any minute, poof.
So, but Lee is, you know, he's out there. He's like, no, you know, patients, medical marijuana patients, they're just like the rest of us. They have every right. They're not separate. They're not a separate group, which is the way law enforcement wants to treat patients, which is why a lot of society wants to treat patients. But Lee is there. He, you know, Lee is mainstreaming patients in his job as a lawyer. That's what I really like about Lee. It's just like, how do we keep the patients first?
It's a good way to look at it is all of the evil consequences of the war on some drugs is a pie, the slice of it that 80% of Americans agree shouldn't be in there, our arrest and prosecutions of people who are using cannabis therapeutically or providing it to patients who are cultivating and providing it to patients who are providing it therapeutically. 70% of the people, generally speaking, support the concept that patients ought to be able to get their medicine at a safe and a regulated location. We haven't been successful in the initiatives in Oregon on that issue. So now we have a lot of illegal, unregulated dispensaries. But yeah, that's so. Maybe what we could do is just go around and people could just say a word or two that is an issue that's of concern to them. And when we get all the way through, we'll see what we can do about hitting as many of them. Would that be a good idea?
I have a question. I guess, like, the sense of the Cannabis Cafe, in the sense of that's almost a federal speakeasy. How does it operate under state? guidelines?
Well, it's operating under state law because under Oregon state law, if you're a cardholder, you can transfer to another cardholder for no consideration up to a pound and a half. And at the cannabis cafe, it's like the cannabis is always free. You know, everything else, you know, water costs money, food, you know, groups like veterans nights, right? And veterans come in there and it's free for them to come in, but they eat up a storm, you know? And so that's how, you know, that's how it works is like cannabis is always free. And it's a good reminder of community. It builds community that way. People come in and go, wow, you mean I don't have to like pay for this? It's like, no. And that's how, you know.
They ring the bell when it's donated.
Yes.
It's like Arby's for potheads.
Well, yeah, it's one of the three ways that cannabis is being distributed, I think, in Oregon.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not direct black market.
Well, it's not. I meant that's being distributed within the Medical Marijuana Act,
yeah.
Or at least with
yeah.
an argument that it's within the
yep.
Medical Marijuana Act. And so one model is the model where everything else costs money except the medicine. That's a model I think maybe can be employed in edibles. You know, but you'd have to sell medicated and unmedicated
and then not
edibles for the same price.
That's what they do currently.
Yeah. So.
I'm wondering, is there, just to get marijuana just legal so it's not like a prohibition like alcohol? I mean, what's going on? I mean, the medical thing is.
No, that's a good question.
A lot of people would do that, but still.
That's a good question. And the answer is there's three initiatives that people are collecting signatures on currently. We had I was on a panel yesterday about that. The three legalization initiatives. There may be another dispensary initiative that hasn't been filed yet, but and we're done talking about medical for now. There's three legalization initiatives. One is OCTA, the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, which is an initiative that Paul Stanford has run off and on over the last 10 or 15 years,
yeah.
I think, anyway. And it would tax and regulate cannabis like alcohol, pretty much. It would set up a cannabis equivalent of the OLCC. Well, I'm working up to... You need to let me get all the way through,
yeah,
and then I can...
Sorry.
That's all right. The second model is... the second initiative that's being circulated is similar to the third one. The second one is a constitutional amendment, and the third one is the one that Paul and I are working on, a statutory amendment. But both are what are called session laws, and session laws is the way that alcohol prohibition ended. What we learned in the litigation involving the concealed handgun license, which is not over quite yet, both counties sheriffs have petition the United States Supreme Court for certiorari, and we should know in October whether we're going to have to file a brief in response to the petition, and we should know whether they're going to take it or not, probably by Thanksgiving, is that the federal government can't force the states to make cannabis illegal under state law. If the state of Oregon wants to remove all the penalties associated with cannabis, it can. And then all that's left is for the federal government to try and enforce the federal law. This is how alcohol prohibition ended. States refused to enforce the Volstead Act, which made it a crime to manufacture and distribute alcohol. The one is a constitutional amendment that would repeal the prohibitions for adults for cultivation and possession and allow the legislature to regulate distribution. The statutory one that Paul and I are working on would remove all penalties for adults for cultivation and possession and require the Oregon Health Authority to regulate. So does that answer your other question also?
Yeah.
So you got Barney Frank on the East Coast basically doing a bill just strike the terms out of the CSA, right? Why wouldn't that just work? I mean, when it's all said and done, why wouldn't... Because that's how prohibition basically ends. So why wouldn't an initiative that I'm kind of exploring? I've got a program that works across many states, different people. Why is that the solution, given all the legal resources that's what they came up with? Was strike the term, right? So why wouldn't that work for you?
To pass an initiative that just removes the word all the time?
Under the state,
so I got lost. Were you asking about why aren't we supporting what Barney Frank's doing?
No,
why aren't we doing something like that in Oregon? We are doing that in the statutory amendment, and I think in the constitutional amendment as well, mm-hmm. as to cultivation and possession. I'm just trying to answer your question. It repeals all those statutes and then reenacts them, but only if you're under 21, right? I'm telling you, that's how it does it. And then we decided that we needed to regulate, that there needed to be regulation, that there wasn't going to be legalization without regulation. We delegated it to the Oregon Health Authority to regulate under the state, the statutory initiative, because we're familiar with them, because we've worked with them, because it's the devil. Paul said it was the devil you know instead of the devil you don't know, and that pretty much carried the day on that decision.
One of the reasons we have to allow, we want the Oregon Health Authority to regulate it, because we deal with prosecutors, and what they bring up to the juries and judges is it's the fear factor. What? It's like, oh no, this is such a horrible plan. It's going to ruin our children. You know, that sort of thing. And so it's like to take away that and say, no, we're gonna allow it to be legal but regulated. Just like alcohol. You know, you can't drive under the influence, that's common sense. You know, you can't sell to children, that's common sense. But you know, other than that, do as you please. You can brew your own beer. Be the same thing. So
John Lucy, Law 420.
Down to John.
So what Paul and I did is Paul talked about me and I talked about him. But you need to talk about your damn self.
So. I got
to
talk about myself? Okay, well, I'm John Lucy.
What makes you most awesome? Go.
Most awesome?
Why is there a star next to your name?
Why is there a star next to my name? Well, I'm John Lucy. I run law420.com, which is a law office in Portland, Oregon. I have another small office in Washington, D.C. that used to do a little bit of stuff with protest work. But since Obama came into office and they don't really arrest protesters anymore, that's kind of died down. My primary practice here is controlled substance criminal defense, specifically medical marijuana law, primarily along with the bulk of my practice related to just generalized marijuana law, but other controlled substance law as well. I used to run North Carolina Normal. I was the director of that for 3 years. Then I moved to D.C. and was a legal researcher and intern for National Normal with Keith Strop and Alan St. Pierre. Then I moved back to North Carolina briefly before I opened law office out here. And I work with Lee and Paul and everybody else in the state on keeping patients out of jail and keeping non-patients out of jail as well, because quite frankly, nobody deserves to be in a metal cage for 1 second over a marijuana plant.
Late, but he showed up with some style, didn't he?
No, John was giving some conflicting information.
Yeah, there was a bit of a snafu in the scheduling.
But he brought it when he got here.
Yes.
The important thing.
So we're just going around getting questions.
Yes. There's a question? Oh, sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Jesus raising the roof.
What's the latest on the farmers market situation?
When you say the latest... Well, we started to talk.
Co-op, if you
we started to talk. We started to talk it's previously
Ashland,
about.
It's Ashland. For an Ashland guy, right?
And most of them closed up recently, and then I haven't heard more since then because I haven't been paying attention to the last month. But just wondering what's the latest on that.
Well, we started talking earlier about how there were essentially three different models for how cannabis is currently being distributed, and the. The one model we talked about already is the cannabis cafe model, where the other things cost money, but there's no money exchanged for the cannabis, so the cannabis is not being distributed among patients for consideration, which takes you out of the protection of the medical act. A second one is, the second and third ones are both premised on the same statutory theory. And the second one is the farmer's market model. And the theory is that the statute that says that a patient can reimburse a grower for the cost of supplies and utilities but not labor, which precisely reads the a registry identification card holder can reimburse a person responsible for a grow site. That's likely to be interpreted to mean any grower, that any patient can reimburse any grower, as opposed to interpreting it to mean only your own grower, only the person you designate. And so the farmers markets, as I, just to finish answering your question, the farmers market model, as I understand it, is that farmers rent a space, or not even, you know, farmers, but just persons responsible for grow sites in indoor gardens, small indoor gardens, who just are proud of what it is that they're able to do and want to help patients, show up at a place where they rent a space and transfer the cannabis or the other usable marijuana for the cost of their supplies and utilities. The former acting U.S. attorney, Dwight Holton, on behalf of the Department of Justice, sent out a letter that was accompanied by a letter from 34 of the 36 district attorneys, saber-rattling, saying, you know, places that were doing either the farmer's market thing or the third model thing were at risk to be, people were at risk to be arrested and prosecuted, and the letter also went to known landlords of these places, and it threatened money laundering and all sorts of, you know, the government's first incremental line of attack is to send threatening letters, because, you know, that's what lawyers do. So some places shut down yep. in response. Some landlords got concerned, and Wake and Bake got raided, and the person who was, in charge of that entered a plea at her initial appearance. She was represented by a lawyer in downtown Portland who, I don't know so well. Do you know her? Celia. She's a well-known, highly regarded federal criminal firm. We don't get to see them in state court on medical marijuana.
No, she used to be a DOJ employee, state DOJ employee, I believe.
So now you're saying it's still defensible as an attorney?
Well, the third model, I started the same sentence three times. I think that there's a basis to be able to defend against it, and I told you what it was. It's a person responsible instead of the person responsible. In the Medical Marijuana Act, they use that phrase interchangeably, and there may be a pattern to it, or maybe there isn't, but there's definitely due process concerns when you can't figure out what it means and whether it means a crime or not. And on the one hand. On the other hand, the text and context of the Medical Marijuana Act seem, to the extent it's ambiguous, the text and context of the act, I think it's likely that a judge will find that that it means your grower, and it doesn't mean any grower, that it's a closed loop thing. You know, on the one hand. On the other hand, only Wake and Bake's been raided. You know? And there's a lot more, and several closed out of fear, but I think more opened. Yes. Yeah, so I think that there's
definitely some have opened since then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's...
They were the third model, right? They were the... What you're asking about is the farmer's model. They were not...
No, they were the third model. The third model is where you... Or it's sort of the pit bull model, is the way I think of it, is the... is that you are... Or also the human...
collective
model, which is that... people form a collective, basically, where you're a member of the club, and you or your grower, if you're your own grower, if you have a grower, then your grower provides medicine to the club and declares what the distribution, what the costs of supplies and utilities were per gram. And it's distributed among members at that per gram price, because the patients are in private, not in a public place, distributing, you know, less than a pound and a half for no consideration. It's a reimbursement from a person responsible for a grow site. In the pit bull model, I think it's more where you come into a room and then you go into another room and then there's a bunch of different display.
It's very similar to the human collective model. I just think that the pit bull, they had the Wake and Bake. They had the unfortunate name of Wake and Bake, and they had the unfortunate publicity in Willamette Week.
And so it was so high profile. And they were in Washington County.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. If people have a place to can choose where they live in Oregon, three cannabis unfriendly counties are Washington, Marion, and Josephine.
Yeah.
Just look at the voting record.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at your voting record.
No, it's
same not Multnomah County people. Look at how red and blue the chart is. Yeah.
Well,
but I haven't had anyone the only collective that I'm aware of that's been raided, and the only one, and Wake and Bake, the name is unfortunate. The name is true.
When Paul and I went to go see the former acting U.S. attorney, he walked around. Oh, I just like the name.
But they were raided. It's my understanding the raid was it was not a federal raid. It's a state raid, and it was done by the county. Specifically, Washington County chose to go after them. Now, in Multnomah County, we have far more of all three or four, however many models you want to say there are, operating currently, and no one's been raided. People have chosen to voluntarily shut down, but others have chosen to voluntarily start up. Yeah. And so, to the best of my knowledge, no one has been, none of the actual facilities themselves have had warrants served or anyone raided.
No,
I think that's right. I think that the...
I was just going to say, one of the reasons it places in the panel before for us, forfeiture reform, is that in that unfortunate article, they, you know, puffed themselves up and saying how much money they were making. And I think Washington County, their law enforcement team said, oh, and they ended up, she did end up forfeiting a large sum of money. So that's what they were most interested in, was the money.
Yeah, I was gonna say a couple of things. First of all, there's almost always a federal agent involved in the state task forces, including the WIND team in Washington County. But the WIND team has been invited to come to the Human Collective. You know, I mean, they're aware of its existence. They're aware of other dispensaries, and they're not involved. The reason why John and Paul and I agree that it's not the best place for cannabis consumers to live is that the sheriff and the prosecutors and the courts are predisposed to be prejudiced against us. It's the first thing you encounter if you practice statewide like the three of us do is that in those counties.
I just added an addendum onto what you were saying about the way it intersects with forfeiture. Also, you know, with the medical marijuana laws, one thing that the federal government can do when they don't necessarily want to, you know, actually go for a criminal prosecution is raid the medical marijuana clinic. This has happened in a lot of places in California. Raid the clinic and just take the stuff. Never bring a criminal charge. That's because they're afraid the jury might just acquit and they can just take the stuff.
Yeah, we're not at that anywhere near that level of enforcement. And I, for one, am really hopeful we're not going to get there with the incoming U.S. Attorney Amanda Marshall.
So you guys, when you're working with them, obviously there's an aspect that they really don't care about it to some degree, right? There's bigger fish to fry. But then there's the part that is ruffling their feather or chapping their behind or whatever. What could you tell us, like, kind of what really gets to them, or I guess with this change it might be irrelevant, but in the past, what really
in the feds or the state or
with the state, yeah, like older.
The blatancy.
When you spoke with them,
the blatancy of the commentary that goes into this, and I first off, it's the same discussion I have with every single one of my clients. If you're going to name something, name it appropriately. I mean, my law office is Law 420, and, you know, it's a little bit of an inside joke for marijuana consumers, but the reality is if you're going to name a place where medicine gets delivered to people, Wake and Bake isn't the name that needs to be on the door. And when you go and you go to the press and you start telling them that you're making money hand over fist, to expect the police not to show up at a place called Wake and Bake looking for the large sums of cash you've just told the local newspaper you make, quite frankly, is I think it's a little silly. I mean, you're putting yourself in a position where you're directly poking the bear.
And even if it's really therapeutic to take a hit off of that 6-foot bong, having that as a picture,
yeah,
in the that takes up most of the so if you're going to venture into any of this kind of cannabis business, it's important to consult with a normal lawyer,
about media stuff, because it's a thing we know about. A lot, most criminal lawyers learn no comment. You know, we're not going to comment about this. We're going to try this case in the courtroom. We're not interested in that convention on these issues. This is about changing attitudes and beliefs and getting people to end us having to do this work. Because yes. There's other work that we all know how to do.
Well, yeah, and Lee had the perfect quote about our outgoing acting U.S. attorney, Dwight Holden, saying, where did he get his medical degree? You know, it's like, you know, that's the bias, the prejudice we face every day. I mean, you know, even in, you know, Clackamas County, which is, you know, compared to Washington County, it's not as bad, but compared to Multnomah County, it's bad there. Yeah, I mean, they laugh at it. And as John said, blatancy. You know, I mean, and they see somebody, a young male, able-bodied male with a card that's found with some weight, the judge is going to say, yeah, you're not a patient. You're just a profiteer.
Well, the other thing is neither of the three of us are privy to what happened. You know, I know that there were, Paul actually has one of the three cases in Josephine County.
Yes.
And I know from speaking with those folks who were arrested that some of the allegations included people coming by that weren't patients wanting to buy and being told that they were waiting on medicine coming from California and all this kind of. So there was evidence of being not in compliance with the Medical Marijuana Act. But, you know, basically there is, it's the same as it always is. There's three ways really to get arrested. One is to piss off your neighbors. One is to is for somebody to see something that they shouldn't. And a third is for somebody to be a part of a transaction that they shouldn't. I mean, there may be, I guess the other one, of course, is to drive in a way that is who you are. You know, whether it's Hispanic or driving while looking like a California medical marijuana patient,
driving
while hippie.
Brown, we were discussing this earlier.
Yeah.
You know, pick up to the gingers. One thing we don't get is pulled over.
Well, we could, let's talk about that.
We get burnt, but
we
not
share that
over.
Sometimes. Yeah. A lot of the cases that John and Paul and I see are roadside stops. So, here are some obscure traffic laws that are good for people to know.
Paul? Well, always use turn signals when changing a lane. You're on a freeway, you think, oh, I'm just going to zip into that lane. No. I mean, you know, all the time I saw it, I followed him for a half a mile and I saw him change lanes twice without using turn signals. Well, he's going to pull you over. So,
and that's, you're an asshole for not using them. That's just my opinion. Use them. You know?
John?
The biggest one that I see constantly is, you know, you're driving down I-5 and you can't seem to remember that you are breaking the law in other ways and you decide that you really need to be speeding. And I can't explain this enough to clients. If you are going 56 in a 55 and they feel like profiling you, they're going to do it. Okay, I've seen stops for 3 miles over where the officer, as he got to the window, he said, where's the marijuana? And, well, why did you put, well, you were speeding, but where's the marijuana, more importantly? And the reality is you're driving down the road. I see clients come in and they have their cars and they have various things on them and things like that. This is the other area. You know what? It's, don't put yourself in the position of fitting the part, so to speak. I mean, as a lawyer, I've had marijuana law stickers on my car before. I have pot leaf stickers on my car every now and again. Quite frankly, I'm not really that worried about it. I can talk to a police officer quite handily. If you're the sort of person, though, who doesn't deal with the police on a daily basis, you probably don't want to out yourself to the guy who's behind you who's looking for a reason to pull you over. And he's looking for a reason to pull you over to say, well, you smoked 6 hours ago, so I'm going to hand you a DUI. And, you know, people say all the time, well, that's ridiculous. Nobody's high after 6 hours. Anybody can drive after smoking 6 hours ago. People get pulled over, they get cited, and they still have to go through the process, and it costs money. Whether or not you don't get convicted at the end of the day, you make a statement about having just smoked recently, you're getting that DUI as soon as the stop happens.
One of the things we do is we train lawyers about representing people who are charged with driving under the influence of cannabis because, under Oregon law, they can't prove it. They just can't. Anybody who knows the law and the science knows that they're incapable of proving it. In Washington, there is an initiative that would make everybody in this room driving under the influence when they went over. It's a per se DUID, a per se driving under the influence of drugs, 5 nanograms, Rick, isn't it? You know, and there's another initiative that is Yup Washington, which is like the Sensible Oregon petition and Sensible California petition, the session law that we were talking about at the beginning, and they're just over there at the top of the hill. Sensible Oregon's right over here. The chief petitioner is right back there.
We'll be up in just a moment, actually. Stay tuned, everybody. I'm going to wrap this up here in a second.
Yeah, any other traffic stuff?
Well, no, and I don't want to forget
what... Don't touch your phone. There's no Facebook.
The signaling...
We're getting pulled over.
The signaling issue...
Especially when you're high.
One thing for the signaling issue, and this is something that I've seen come up every now and again, particularly in downtown, it's actually not legal to make a lot of turns in downtown because you can't signal the sufficient distance in order to make the turn legally. And this is an instance where you have to signal. Off the top of my head, I'm going to say it's 150.
It is
150. It's 150 feet you have to signal. Well, some of the blocks are actually shorter than that. And so you end up in this position where you make a turn and you can't legally make your next turn that you want to make. You actually have to go down 2 blocks, make a turn, go up 2 blocks, make a turn, go down 2 blocks and make a turn. And it sounds ridiculous that an officer would use that as a means of pulling you over, but if he wants in your vehicle that day...
Well,
you may well do it.
Yeah, and the other one is that we're in Oregon, folks. Don't do a California stop. No. I mean, I've been profiled and pulled over for doing a California stop. You know, that's where you kind of roll up to a stop sign and you almost stop and it's clear and you roll through without actually coming to a full stop. They can pull you over for that. They pulled me over, and the officer was quite unhappy when he realized it was a lawyer in a car.
U-turns.
My nemesis.
I just wanted to...
For out-of-staters, by the way, U-turns are illegal in Oregon unless posted, which isn't common in a lot of states. If you're not from here and you haven't lived here that long.
They are illegal.
They are...
You say they're illegal unless it's posted that you can do it?
U-turns are generally illegal unless posted.
Legal.
Right.
Legal.
Unless posted.
Right.
Yeah.
Unless posted, then it's not.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, you said it the first time you said the
broker. And I had all my stuff, you know, but then he got me and he asked me if I had been around marijuana. And I told him no, you know, because I knew where he was going with it. But then he got me to get out of the car and do a search, which had never happened to me before. Mm-hmm. And so I'm reaching him, like, hoping I don't have anything, you know, and I didn't have anything on me. And then he thought for sure I had something and he went and looked inside the cab. I'm just wondering at that point, what are their legal rights? Say no,
because
he already was
going to
think that there was something going on. I mean,
I got lost in where.
Well, I mean, I think
he asked.
You know, actually, a specific question about
a
specific case
is a
appropriate thing for a private consultation.
Yep.
And it's not a thing that's good to talk about in public. I wanted to close with 3 things, if I could.
Oh, okay.
Is that all right? I'll talk to you afterwards, if you want. But I just don't think it's a good idea to talk about it in this room.
That was years ago.
Oh, all right.
When have you said too much, just for a general thing, when have you said too much when you're in the presence of an officer?
When you've opened your mouth.
Well, you need to open your mouth. And you need to say, I choose to exercise my right to silence.
Yep.
But that's a little bit further along in the story. Where we are in the story is that they're pulling people over for traffic violations. And even obscure ones that lawyers might not be sure about. Because the traffic code enables them to stop the car. Once they've stopped the car, current Oregon law is that if they say they can smell marijuana, then they have probable cause to search. They don't have to actually smell marijuana. We all have cases where they said they could smell marijuana and there wasn't marijuana, but that's the reason. We're seeing a lot of that. The second thing I wanted to say was what our friend Jeffrey Steinborn, who's a normal lawyer in Seattle, always says, and John alluded to, which is, don't do 2 crimes at the same time. 1 crime at a time. And then the third thing, and the most important thing, is the interacting with the police thing. And it's really just three things. The first thing is, am I free to leave? And if you are, then leave. The second thing is, if I'm not free to leave, I exercise my right to silence. Because the United States Supreme Court said that silence alone isn't adequate evidence that you've exercised your right to silence. As counterintuitive as it seems, that's what they said. And this is after Rehnquist, the pillhead. It's, you know, the current court said this. And then the third thing to say is, I want to talk to my lawyer. I don't have anything to say unless my lawyer's here. Can I call my lawyer now?
Oh, so, and I always say, too, I do not consent to any searches.
Yeah.
Make sure that that's on the record. You know, because they'll try to, on a traffic stop, they'll put a form in front of your face, and, oh, sign here, no big deal. Nope.
And we were advising people for a while on the driving under the influence of cannabis cases, P, no DRE.
Yeah. Yep.
So you can refuse the DRE, and it's not a suspension of your license. If you refuse the urine test, it is.
Just like,
and of course it's in your urine.
What's DRE?
Drug recognition exam.
Say no to this, don't do it.
Yep. You don't have to perform, because that's an act, you know, and because they'll, you know, make,
they're
you,
asking you to create evidence against you.
Yes, that's the that's the legal,
like,
way to say it.
Like,
well, there are field sobriety tests that come before there's the drug recognition.
The DRE
is when they bring in a separate police officer.
Yeah, the DRE is usually in the police station. So sometimes they'll tell you they're looking for the DRE officer to come in. Other times they won't tell you. They'll just, like, be chummy, and then before you know it, they're slapping the blood pressure cuff on you. Yeah, it's one of those phony pseudoscience things they teach in D.C. at the FBI Academy or in Quantico.
John, you want to close us out with anything?
All I want to say is the same things that, you know, Paul and Lee have said. I put it at the bottom of every single one of my cards, just in an easy way to say it, and it just says, remember to be polite, but assert your legal rights. I do not consent to any searches. I do not wish to answer any questions. I invoke my right to silence, and I wish to consult with my attorney. And if you can get that sentence out, most of the time you'll save yourself a couple grand.
Or magic words.
Legalese, everybody.